Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. We begin today's program in the Chinese capital, Beijing, where authorities took drastic steps to deal with a new wave of thick air pollution. They ordered half of the city's cars off the road and advised schools to stop classes. The measures are part of a red alert, the highest ever air pollution warning that has been issued by the Beijing government. Beijing correspondent Bill Bertels tells Eleanor Hall, what's it like to feel in the streets?
Well, Eleanor, I do have my anti-pollution mask, but I'm not wearing it in case the sound is a little bit muffled for this interview. But generally speaking, I'm not alone. Most people are wearing pollution masks today. And when you look at buildings which are only, say, 100 metres away, yes, you can clearly see them, but they're looking a bit hazy. And certainly from the bureau, from the balcony of our bureau, which is 12 stories up, you have a very nice view across the city. On a clear day, you can clearly see buildings which are about 500 metres away, but today you can barely see them. So that gives you an idea of what it looks like. As for what it feels like, there's certainly a smell in the air. It's a sort of chemically industrial sort of smell, and you smell this quite often when the pollution gets up here in Beijing.
So what exactly does a red alert mean for locals?
So this is a warning which contains some of them are strict regulations and some of them are recommendations. So first of all, the government is forcing about half the cars off the roads in Beijing. They do this according to your number plate. If you have a number plate ending with an odd number, you can only drive on odd days in the calendar, and the opposite for even number plates. So that, of course, means that roughly half the cars all of a sudden are gone. And you can see this when you walk out on the streets. There is much lighter traffic today than normal. There is also restrictions for factories and for construction sites, which basically shuts a lot of them down. And it's hoped that that would reduce the amount of pollution that they put into the air. But maybe the most interesting one is the regulation around schools. So the government doesn't force schools to close, but it strongly recommends that they close, or at the very least, they adopt flexible measures so that the parents who have no choice can still take their kids to school, but for most parents, they don't have to. So that's the regulation which I guess would cause maybe the most inconvenience. But when you speak to a lot of parents here in Beijing, they say that the schools are closed and a lot of the children are staying home.
Must be very worrying for the health of children. What are people telling you there about how they're coping with the pollution and with the regulations?
People are generally quite supportive of this red alert. I got the chance to speak to a few people on the streets today. To give you some context, this time last week, there was this incredibly thick, dense smog that engulfed Beijing. And it was actually, according to the Air Quality Index, the worst pollution for 2 years. And today is not quite as bad. The Air Quality Index is hovering somewhere around the 250 to 300 mark. To give you an idea of what's regarded as healthy, 25 to 50 is recommended as a healthy level. But last week it was around 600. So people generally this week, I got the chance to speak to them today. They said that the situation is pretty bad, but they are happy to see the government issuing this red alert. This is what some of them had to say this morning.
You've got to protect yourself. I wear a pollution mask and won't be going outside too much. You have to do all you can to stay at home.
Reducing the number of cars on the road will cut the pollution level, and stopping classes in schools will be very good for the children's health. Yes, it's a little inconvenient, but this is a government decision.
Some of the residents of Beijing there. So, Bill, is it clear why there is a particularly high level of pollution at the moment?
Yeah, this is a phenomenon you see in the northeast of China during winter because it is so cold here. So people are pumping up the central heating systems. A lot of these systems run on coal-fired boilers. But also in some of the smaller towns surrounding Beijing, people are buying coal bricks and they're just burning them inside their home to keep warm because it's such a cheap form of heating. So this pumps a lot of smoke and soot into the air. And if it is windy, it's not such a problem. The pollution will disperse. But what's happened this week is there is 3 or 4 days where the air is very still. And so authorities here say that's the reason the pollution is hanging around. But last week, there is some hope. Last week, when the pollution was even stronger, overnight, it just suddenly dissipated. And the following day, Beijing experienced the most wonderfully blue and clear skies. So when the wind does finally get up in a couple of days, people here are hoping that once again, they will see a dramatic improvement.
In India, a number of people are dead after a private hospital lost its power. The blackout happened during a heavy downpour and flooded the city streets of Chennai in southern India. The region has seen the heaviest rainfall in a century, with around 280 people believed to have been killed so far. Penny Timms reports.
Intensive rainfall in the Indian city of Chennai is believed to have taken out generators powering life support systems in the private hospital. It led to the deaths of at least 14 patients being treated in the hospital's intensive care unit. Health officials have confirmed the deaths, but say further investigations are needed. Residents say it's a dangerous situation.
We are facing lots of problems due to this flooding. There is also power shortage. The flooding makes it very difficult to survive. We can even see snakes in the water.
The same downpour forced rescue helicopters to be grounded. Elsewhere, military choppers have been used to deliver food to people who've been stranded on rooftops for days. But help is yet to reach many areas, despite the deployment of around 4,000 soldiers. Rear Admiral Alok Baknagar says authorities are doing what they can.
Part of the relief material that we got has been handed over to the state administration. And now we've got all the boats on which our personnel, along with ready-to-eat meals and water supplies, will be deployed in the flood-affected areas. We are right now intending to deploy north of Adyar River and move south towards the river and provide these relief material.
The flooding is the worst the region has seen in a century. More than 345 millimetres fell in just over 24 hours on December the 1st. Since then, the rains have continued. Many residents had hoped the situation was easing after floods began to recede. But those hopes were short-lived after more rain sent people scrambling for higher ground. Some parts of the coastal city remain under 2.5 metres of water. Earlier, the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi travelled to the region and pledged around $150 million US to help with the disaster.
I have seen the damage and misery caused by the extremely heavy rainfall. The government of India stands by the people of Tamil Nadu in their hour of need. I have directed that rupees 1,000 crore be released immediately by the government of India to Tamil Nadu for immediate relief.
He's blamed the floods on climate change.
This week marked the 40th anniversary of Indonesia's most significant conflict, its invasion of East Timor. But this significant anniversary of a controversial war has gone almost unmarked in Indonesia, except for a small commemoration at the headquarters of the National Special Forces, Kompassus. Foreign journalists are barred from the event, but Indonesia's correspondent Adam Harvey was able to file this report.
At a military base in South Jakarta, Indonesia's Special Forces veterans gather to remember their war, the invasion of East Timor. A video presentation shows them as fit young men. They're all in their 60s and 70s now, and some of them can barely walk. They're wearing casual batik shirts and the distinctive red beret of Kompassus. These Special Forces soldiers saw the worst of the fighting in the months following the landings in Dili on December 7, 1975. Indonesian Government Minister Luhut Panjaitan was a Kompassus commando in East Timor. He was the main attraction at yesterday's commemoration. 40 years ago, we went out for operation in East Timor from this building. Of course, there are a lot of memories. More than 100,000 Timorese died in the conflict, which ended only when Indonesia allowed a referendum on independence in 1999. It's still a sensitive topic here. I was made to sit in a Kapasus guardhouse during yesterday's event. Our Indonesian cameraman was allowed in and recorded Luhut Panjaitan being asked what lessons were learned. Good planning, and I think this shows the spirit of Kapasus, which is never give up, risking everything to do their duty. It was a controversial war notable for many human rights abuses, but it is remarkable how little discussion of it there is in Indonesia. Rafendi Jamin is the director of the Human Rights Working Group Indonesia. He's one of the few who knows the significance of December 7.
It is not something that is remembered by general public at all.
Luhut Panjaitan says that he and his fellow commandos thought they were doing the right thing in a global fight against communism. In December 1975, as the Special Forces mission began against East Timor's left-wing government, US Secretary of State Henry Kissinger was in Jakarta for talks with President Suharto. Kissinger was visiting Jakarta, actually giving a green light for the operation because of the fear of communism. That was the briefing that we received. So when the next day we were blamed, it was politics. I learned that we were blamed for things while we tried our best to carry out our duty. Rafendi Jamin agrees that in 1975, Indonesia was in step with the West. The Australian government made no objection to the invasion.
It was really part of the Cold War when the anti-communist regime of Indonesia at the time in 1975 were happily joining the forces of Australia and the West.
Yesterday's Kapasus event ended with the Special Forces theme song. With that, the veterans of Indonesia's most controversial war hobbled out of the marquee and back into the daylight. This is Adam Harvey from Jakarta.
Staying in East Timor, East Timor says it's acting on an audit of its agriculture minister that it found irregularities in millions of dollars worth of contracts intended to help East Timor farmers. East Timor is in a race against time to boost its agricultural production, not just to improve the lives of farmers, but so it can also find other sources for when its oil and gas fields run out. The government says it's implementing the recommendations of the agricultural audit to make sure spending reaches those who need it. Sarah Everington has filed this report from the southwest village of Dili.
Like many of East Timor's farmers, 31-year-old Paulo de Santos de Cruz grows enough food to feed his young family, but he struggles to make a profit. He says he makes just $140 a year from his farm in the village of Fahilebo in the hills southwest of Dili. Yes, it is enough to feed the family, he says, but I need to find other work from somewhere else. East Timor's Minister for Agriculture, Estanislao da Silva, wants to help farmers boost their agricultural production. For about a decade, East Timor's economy has been highly dependent on oil and gas for revenue. Estanislao da Silva wants to change that.
To develop agriculture and then also to give them opportunity to generate income and jobs in rural areas.
For about 15 years, an Australian aid program has been trying to help farmers grow enough crops to sell. The Seeds of Life program has been testing different varieties of crops for local farming groups. The program's Australian team leader is John Dalton.
Now there's an additional six or so legumes will be released very soon. So that broadens the opportunity for improved nutrition.
The Agriculture Minister, Estanislao da Silva, says boosting agricultural production is good for farmers and for the country.
We need to look at our alternatives, investment to generate a job and income for the country apart from oil and gas, because they are not going to be there forever. So then the country can be more prosperous without having to rely entirely on oil and gas.
But a report by East Timor's Audit Chamber on the Agriculture Ministry between 2011 and 2013 has found irregularities in millions of dollars worth of local contracts that were intended to help local farmers.
to wake us up, to say that there are checks and balance, so don't take everything for granted.
Mr. De Silva was not the minister at the time. He took over early this year. He says he's been restructuring the ministry and acting on the report.
So then we can avoid committing the same mistakes in the future.
Mr. De Silva says the Australian aid program was not affected by any mismanagement. He says the audit chamber's report has been handed to East Timor's public prosecutor and the Anti-Corruption Commission. The minister says the government is trying to make sure its spending hits the ground.
A group which monitors Rohingya Muslims fleeing Myanmar has found the number setting sail for Thailand and Malaysia are slowing. Earlier this year, an exodus of tens of thousands of people prompted a crisis meetings across Southeast Asia. The slowdown since then could be seen as a stem of Myanmar's new political climate or a crackdown on people smuggling. South Asia correspondent Liam Cochrane reports.
The ethnic Rohingyas of Myanmar's west coast are considered one of the most persecuted groups in the world. Flare-ups of violence, backed by militant Buddhist groups, have forced thousands of Muslim Rohingyas into camps, unwanted in the country many have called home for generations. The calmer weather of this time of year has traditionally provided an opportunity to flee by boat to Thailand and Malaysia, with a small number carrying on towards Australia. Chris Lewar is the director of the Arakan Project, an advocacy group which monitors the movement of Rohingyas.
We have so far tracked about five boats that have left since September, which is very, very small. About in total, that would make about 1,000 people in total.
And compared to what? What was the volume of people that were going last year?
Last year, well, in 2 weeks in October, when the season started at the time, we had more than 13,000.
There are two main reasons for the dramatic reduction in the number of Rohingyas fleeing, according to Chris Lewar: the historic election in Myanmar, won by Aung San Suu Kyi's opposition party, and a crackdown by Thai authorities on people smugglers.
There are far less boat and smuggler involved because of the fact they can't really disembark people in Thailand. At least that's what they tell the passengers. The other thing, of course, in November, we have no departure in November at all. And we believe that is because of the election. The victory of Aung San Suu Kyi and NLD have given hope to many Rohingya that something will change in the country.
On Friday, the countries affected by irregular migration in the Indian Ocean got together in Bangkok to discuss policy options. There were promises of concrete actions, but the Southeast Asian nations couldn't agree on a regional plan put forward by Thailand, and the meeting ended with talk of more talks. Upichat Chinwano is Thailand's permanent Secretary of Foreign Affairs, and he told reporters 70 to 80% of those fleeing Myanmar are ethnic Bengalis, leaving Bangladesh for greener economic pastures, not persecuted Rohingyas.
But the delegation from Myanmar has stated quite clearly that they will honour the responsibility that they have.
It's not clear what it means for Myanmar to honour its responsibilities, considering the country continues to impose harsh conditions on Rohingyas. With little hope for change anytime soon, the trickle of asylum seekers and economic migrants leaving Myanmar is set to continue, says Chris Lewar.
December, January is usually the highest, actually. So let's see. And we know that apparently there is now, right now, a boat that is about to start embarking people.
Each boat setting off carries the hopes of dozens, sometimes hundreds of people, and reinforces the challenges of a regional issue that's not going away.
Sexual education is a taboo in Burma, and has long been a taboo. In fact, there are dangerous myths that persist about the female anatomy and male supremacy. Such is the superstition that some women's clothing can sap men of their masculine power. In recent years, though, classes have been put together to teach adult women the truth about their bodies for the first time. Some even go as far to talk about female masturbation. The new sex education programs are popular, but at the same time controversial. Teachers have been threatened for running such classes. Angelia Lavampierre attended one such class and prepared this report.
That's the sound of about 40 adults taking a sex education class. It's a radical notion in Burma, where public knowledge about sex, reproductive health and women's bodies is at times dangerously low. I've travelled to the fringes of Burma's largest city, Yangon, to visit the headquarters of a group called Akaya Women, set up in 2008 to help turn the tide. The group's founder, Tata, says in Burma, the misconceptions about sex are many and varied.
Lots of myths, small, big. When they combine together, it's really dangerous. It is the main cause of gender inequality in Myanmar. For example, we don't know what blood it is, so we think this blood, the period, blood, menstrual blood, is very dirty and rotten. It is not a fresh blood. Because of this blood is dirty, women are considered to be lower than men.
That view that women are inferior to men because of their periods has led to some strange practices.
We don't wash together with men clothes and women clothes. And after you wash it, you have to hang, right? So all the other things can be hang in the normal or upper string, but the woman has to be in the lower string. Because they cannot touch together. If you touch together and do it in the same pile and do it, men will lose their glory or power status.
Remarkably, these sex ed classes don't stop at the basics. They discuss things that might be considered radical even in Australia, including female masturbation.
This is the area, all this vagina, clitoris, lips, anus area. If you touch it, you feel good. We connected with child development. Child touch it to learn about it. They wanted to do it because they feel good. So we introduce this as a way, it is normalizing it so that they started to realize, oh.
It's a lot to learn in a couple of days, especially for women who've never looked at their own vaginas.
99% of the women in Myanmar, 99.9, we've never seen our vagina. How does it look? Sometimes we didn't even know we have two holes, like one for shoe pee, one for menstrual period and delivery. And this happened to many, many women who already have 2-3 kids.
Win-Win Kaying is in her 40s and has 10-year-old twin sons. Speaking with me through one of the teachers at Akaya, she says she was shocked by some of the lessons.
The most surprising thing for her is the sexuality training, because now she is over 40 years old, and in this training she has learned many new things that she has never known all the 40 years, so she liked the training.
Understandably, the course is popular, but according to Tata, not everyone's a fan.
We have threats from this religious groups. We have threats from individual men, the rapists, the fathers, because we are providing services for the survivors. So we need support from police.
26-year-old Zin Min Thu has been a teacher with Akaya for 2 years, but she still hasn't worked up the nerve to tell her father the truth about her job.
He thought that sexuality is not good for me because I'm single, so I shouldn't talk about that kind of thing because they do not know. He doesn't know about sexuality very educated. They just know about it is their daddy words.
Unlike her father, her friends know what she does. Her male friends sometimes tease her about it, but these days she knows how to reply.
I was told this guy, I know what are you talking about, Annie. I know what's are you thinking about me? So stop thinking and stop chasing me. So they are afraid of me. I think they don't want me make offense, you know.
Where does that confidence come from?
Knowing about our sexuality and knowing about our bodies, and also knowing that the spice of human being, that sexuality is not harm our life. Sexuality also make benefits for us, is changing me and make me comfortable and powerful.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus at pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program again, as well as all past editions, by visiting our website, www.pcjmedia.com. That's www.pcjmedia.com. And click on the link, which you'll find on the right menu for Focus Asia Pacific. A special thank you goes to ABCRN. I'm Keith Palom in Taipei, Taiwan. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye. Yeah.